Being on the receiving end of a divorce doesn't mean that I wasn't worth fighting for, right? Reaching the end of my rope didn't mean that I don't have what it takes. Having needs doesn't mean I'm too needy. We're not some kind of second-class citizens or you know, we couldn't cut it at the marriage game, so to speak. We didn't make that grade. We are no longer accepting the things we cannot change. We are changing the things we can no longer accept. If that's not empowerment, I don't know what is.
Welcome to the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast, where we explore the journey from heartbreak to healing and transformation. Here are your hosts, Chris Rocha and Jen Howie.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast, where we talk about all things betrayal, all things recovery, and all things transformation. I am your host, Chris Rocha, and I'm here with my co-host and one of my dearest friends, Jen Howie. And I usually have a clever quip or nickname for her, but right now I don't have a clever name because Jen and I are both struggling with seasonal ick, bronchitis and congestion and all of that. And I just want to hug you, Jen, and get that hug back from you. So I'm just going to say I'm here with my fellow sickie, yes. Jen Howie. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Chris. It's good to see you. I miss the days where you and I lived in the same place and we were able to give real hugs instead of virtual hugs. But yes,
I'm with you.
We're here together nonetheless and happy to be here. So yeah. I'm excited about today. I feel like I start off every podcast saying I'm excited about today. I'm excited about today because we're talking about a really tough subject with a really dynamic individual. So I would say for any listener who's listening today, whatever preconceived notions you have about divorce, set them aside for the next 45 minutes and take in with an open mind and an open heart what's coming your way today. I know that I have my preconceived ideas about it. You and I, Chris, we've both been divorced and we've both been remarried. We've both blended. We both have grandbabies. You know, we've run the gamut. And today's episode is going to be very special. So who's our guest today, Chris?
Our guest today is Ray Galen Emerson. Did I say Galen correctly?
You did.
Good. Ray is a master certified life, relationship, and divorce recovery coach with over a decade of experience in relational trauma, including abandonment, abuse, addiction, betrayal, deception, divorce, and infidelity. She's the founder of Healing Talks Back, LLC, where she offers a trauma-informed coaching, consultation, and supervision. Ray is also a formerly trained mentor coach and coaching supervisor, actively involved in the International Coaching Federation, otherwise known as ICF. They are the gold standard for professional coaches in the United States and I think internationally even. Yeah, I just said that, didn't I? And serves on the board of the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists. And our listeners have heard us talk about APSATs before. And a little closer to home, Ray is actually my APSAT supervisor guiding me through that certification process, which is so intense and good. Welcome, Ray, to the podcast. We're so glad you're here to talk to us today about a divorce after betrayal trauma, which is, you're going to educate us on why that is kind of a unique experience or a unique category. It's different. Please say hi to our listeners and tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. Well, thank you, Chris, and good to see you and good to meet you for the first time, Jen. This has been as we were discussing before, kind of an area of my work that I stumbled into in a sense. I knew starting out in my work with couples navigating through relational trauma that I wanted to be able to focus on solutions and support, whether the relationship survived and healed and recovered and reunified or whether it didn't. Because when we look at the kind of long-term experience of couples healing from betrayal trauma, we realize that sometimes they heal together in a relationship, and sometimes they heal separately after the end of a relationship. And so looking at that reality, that was something that I didn't want to lose off my radar in terms of the help I was training and practicing and supervising and getting all of the everything I needed to get my work in this field off on what I felt like was a broad spectrum kind of a foundation. And so what I found was that there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of professionals working to help couples who are staying together. And there are not very many professionals looking to support or prepared that feel equipped, really fully equipped to support those that don't. And so that has become one of my niche specializations, not necessarily by intention, but certainly by passion. Like I sometimes talk to friends or family or colleagues or acquaintances who think that my work is depressing. Like the idea of working with divorce survivors is somehow, the failure cases or the ones that didn't cut it or didn't make the grade or, you know, couldn't make it work, whatever kind of vernacular you want to put on it. And I always love busting that myth and saying that seriously, truly, my work with divorce survivors is one of my favorite kinds of work. There's something especially inspiring and satisfying about it.
You're right. It is such an untouched niche, and we're grateful that this is what you offer. So it is unique. It is necessary. It is almost urgently needed.
Thank you.
All right, Jen, take it away.
All right. So you share about the healing and the aftermath of the terminally wounded relationship. So many questions already.
What is a terminally wounded relationship? Okay. So you talk about that aftermath. And the healing from betrayal is distinctively different for partners whose relationships actually just don't survive. So can you break that down for our audience and identify maybe some of those key differences for us?
Yeah, I absolutely can. And, you know, when I use terms like terminally wounded or mortally wounded relationships, I'm referring to those situations where the relationship wound was fatal for the relational unit, meaning there was no intervention that brought it back to a state of sustainability, right? So I'm kind of a word nerd. So I try to find the words that I feel fit well for a scenario that I'm describing. And sometimes it translates to those listening and sometimes it doesn't. But that's the story behind a term like terminally wounded relationships. But here's the thing. So in order to identify that there are things that are different, we kind of begin with this predicate understanding that many things are the same, right? Like there is a rupture, there is a trauma, there is a wound, there is an injury, there are all of those existential experiences that are very similar to a situation when someone discovers betrayal, processes betrayal, and heals from betrayal. But then we see the things that are really significantly and kind of irrefutably different. And there's really three factors that I kind of identify and isolate in terms of what are the big game changer differences for those healing within relationships that are surviving and those healing in the aftermath of relationships that didn't. So one of those factors is permanence. So we all know that hope is powerful. And when you've got two people that have even a sliver, even a teeny tiny itty bitty molecule of hope for their relationship, that hope is a driver. And that hope is an anchor. And that hope gets them through the day and gets them over the hard parts and through the pain in so many different ways. When that hope shifts and is no longer holding that space for the relationship, there's a kind of like a screeching halt to that energy that has propelled and sustained those parties up until that point. So I kind of think of it as like, you know, you're driving down the freeway, your car's going, you know, at full speed, and all of a sudden you throw it into reverse because what you've been doing is putting everything you've got into holding a relationship together. And even at points when it feels like it's all falling apart, you don't sense that it's the end of the story yet. When you reach a point of either initiating a divorce or responding to a divorce, it can happen in both directions, sometimes more than two directions, there's a sense of that hope coming to an end and that sense of permanence. There is no more hope to be hoped for this. There's no more fight to be fought for this. I'll sometimes say this is where those sometimes dreams go to die, right? So that permanence factor is one of the things that is significantly different from when you're healing within a relationship that is still kind of riding that wave of hope. Another factor is the publicity piece. Like, not in all, it's not true in all cases. Some of us go through betrayal trauma scenarios where it's not private. We don't have the option or the autonomy to keep it to ourselves if we want to. But in most cases, we do. We have some degree of control over who knows what about what's going on in our personal lives and relationships, but nobody gets divorced and nobody knows about it. Like, when you go through a divorce, the whole world knows that your marital status is changing. And so you're kind of going through this extremely stressful, and we could talk all day about that, but this extremely stressful life experience in a fishbowl, surrounded by people with strong opinions about what's happening in your life, and they are having their own experience of your divorce. So my divorce coaching instructor once said, it's kind of like when you're pregnant and people find out you're pregnant, one of the first things they'll come back with is, well, when I was pregnant, blah, 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 blah. When my sister was pregnant, this happened to her. When my cousin was pregnant, don't let that happen. You know, all these stories that are really projections of other people's divorce experiences onto you. So that publicity factor is another one that comes with a lot of stigma, a lot of shame, a lot of preconceptions, like you said, Jen, and that makes it really tough too. And I think the third one, and the one I don't talk about as much, but I kind of am feeling like I need to be talking about it more, is the isolation component. So if you think about it, when you're fighting to save a relationship, there is at least one other person that is in that trench with you, right? Like, there's at least a counterpart that you have, your relational partner, and regardless of how invested that other person is, but you're in that part together. At the point when you're either initiating or facing a divorce, that's no longer true. That person is no longer in that trench with you. So you really are, by default, suddenly very alone in your healing process. You now have kind of that sole responsibility for the tasks of trauma resolution within your life. And additionally to that, again, because other people around you have their own experience of your divorce, it's almost a contagion kind of a concept, like this sense of, if it could happen to you, it could happen to me. That's scary. And oftentimes our support system gets very self-protective and self-preservatory and can really pull back in ways that may be legitimately healthy for them, but can be profoundly isolating and painfully othering, is the word I use for it in quotes, to the person going through it. I'll sometimes tell the story when my ex-husband and I got divorced. We were 10 years into our recovery in a very active 12-step recovery and therapy community. And get this, most of my closest recovery friends were married to most of his closest recovery friends. So at the juncture where our marriage ended, my whole support system was terrified because we were the ones who'd made it 10 years. Like, we were the ones who had the outcome so far that they were hoping to have in their relationships. And when we fell apart, so did they. And so there was this sense of, I can't get too close to that. I can't feel that pain with you because that is something I can't yet face as a possibility or a potential outcome for my own relationship. So I just went on a whole ridiculously long time in answer to your question there, Jen, but that sense of the permanence, the publicity, and the isolation, those are three things that are pretty different for survivors of betrayal-related separation and divorce.
Thank you for giving us some language. I just wrote down that contagion factor. I hadn't thought of that before, and that is so true. Even irreconcilable differences kind of situation of divorce, that is a psychological factor that definitely has taken place in my mind. Mm-hmm. But all the more in a betrayal situation. Wow, that was excellent. So, Ray, if a relationship involving betrayal is so traumatizing, and we know that it is, shouldn't the end of that relationship provide some deep and lasting relief? I mean, I know someone right now contemplating, do I stay or do I go after 9 years of hard, hard work? And I would think that when you finally say, okay, game over, it's time to move on, that there'd be this kind of, you know, wiping of the brow sensation, you know, like, okay, all right, time to move on. Next chapter, let's go. But what would you say to survivors who are confused when divorce actually makes everything feel much worse?
Yeah. So I love this question. I love this conversation because this is one of my favorite myth-busting roles in my work, because there really is some serious misunderstanding socially and conventionally that divorce stops the impact of the relational trauma that precedes it. That doesn't usually happen. It changes the impact, it alters or redirects or reframes the impact, but it doesn't immediately and sometimes doesn't indeterminately stop that impact. So one of the things that I think is really important for us to recognize is that divorce is traumatic regardless of the circumstances. So even when it is a necessary act of self-preservation, or even when it is the healthiest available option, it is still traumatic. It's not this extension of betrayal trauma. It's like a whole other trauma sandwiched down on top of it. And there's this quote that I love, and I use it all the time, from a rabbi who wrote a book called Divorce is a Mitzvah. And he talks about divorce as an amputation. And this is what he says about it. He says, deciding to end a marriage is like deciding to amputate a limb. You know there is enormous pain in store for you. You know there will be a long period of recovery. You know you will be changed forever in ways that cannot be fully anticipated. But one thing is for sure, divorce is not, as so many people think, the easy way out. Not ever. Divorce is never the easy way out. And he talks about this phantom pain experience where getting this amputation might save your life, but it's going to be hella dramatic in the process, right? So this idea that oftentimes at that point of terminating a relationship, when things feel like they're getting worse, sometimes it's because they actually are getting worse. So there might be a sense in which the divorce is the long-term solution, but in the short term or in an indeterminate term, it creates more problems because there's a legal process to go through. There is an emotional process to go through. There is a literal separation, like an extrication of your whole life happening. Not always on your terms. You do not always get agency and choice to decide how that plays out. So oftentimes the way that I kind of look at it is divorce doesn't end the trauma. It closes the door on one kind of trauma or one form of trauma, but it also opens the door for different kinds of trauma. So my clients will often come up saying, what fresh hell is this? Right? Like there's always another trauma for a different kind or different manifestation of it on a different day. And here's the thing where it gets tricky. So divorce doesn't usually happen the day after discovery. Like that almost never happens. Divorce usually happens most commonly, kind of like some anecdotal surveys I've done, within that 2 to 5 year period. We see other kind of milestones at which it tends to occur, but it happens when betrayal survivors already have a good grip on a lot of the recovery tools that got them stable enough to find themselves in a situation of deciding the fate of the marriage in the first place. So they've got a good grip on boundaries. They've got a good grip on their values. They've got a good grip on using their voice, all of these things. And then you bring in this huge tectonic shift. And so this sense of confidence and competence that survivors have developed in recovery ultimately ends up feeling anemic and ineffective. And they find themselves really struggling because I was doing well. And now that everything's changing, I'm having to kind of relearn or readapt to things that I didn't necessarily think I'd be facing again or would be coming up again. And then kind of finding that new support system and wondering who can hold space for me in this different state and stage of my recovery.
Mm-hmm. And that's a hard one because most people, especially if you're with other couples who are going through a healing process, that is very, very difficult because your entire friend group may shift. So there might be multiple losses that you're mm-hmm. experiencing when taking that next step, especially if you've been going through recovery for some amount of time and people have walked alongside you for that amount of time. And now here you are
gaining the boundaries, gaining the perspective, gaining whatever it took inside of you to be in this place that you're now currently in, and using those tools to change all the rules for everybody involved. Mm-hmm. There's so much there. You know, so many people will come into this process in the very beginning and like, should I leave or should I go? And yeah, it's kind of like that, you know, let's get everyone out of the emergency room, out of ICU. Let's develop the skills to make decisions based off of our values, not off of our trauma that we're currently, experiencing and all of that. And then you have the couples that are like you 10 years into the process and people are going, what now? You're doing it now? I mean, you're 10 years in.
Also, when you make that shift to, okay, divorce, there's two things in my brain. One, we've had all this practice about learning what healthy boundaries are. And if divorce is the healthy boundary, and yet you're going to now cause all these other people trauma, or this choice, this boundary, this decision is going to cause trauma, including maybe your children, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you've tried to protect your children from the pain and shield them from it and even maybe hide it from them. Now you're bringing your kids into this trauma, which I think isn't divorce in the top five of most stressful, traumatic things that you can experience in your life, like death, moving, a new job, divorce, right?
Yep.
And divorce is a death of a marriage and a future and a hope that you had, even a death of all the years spent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know?
Yeah, so, yeah, there's a lot of that non-concrete, so kind of that intangible, ambiguous loss and grief that accompanies this process. And you're right, according to an oldie but goodie study done like back in the 70s. It's the number two ranked stressful event, second only to death of a marital spouse. So it is a hugely stressful life event. And you're right, there are different emotions that come along with being the one whose partner decided to divorce. So you're on the receiving end of a divorce, sometimes a divorce you didn't or don't want, or whether you're the one to initiate the divorce. One brings with it a sense of abandonment. The other brings with it a sense of guilt. And there's kind of like, you know, people ask, well, which is easier? I don't think there is an easier. They're both terribly difficult to navigate. So I'm sorry, I feel like I interrupted you. But yeah, that sense of there being like lots of losses and concentric circles of losses, like there's lots of depth and nuance and stretch to the impact of this huge decision.
Well, that's a really great segue into the next question, because you're going to talk to us a little bit. Well, tell us a little bit about that disconnect or that marginalization expressed by partners that are moving through separation and divorce, you know, where they feel like they no longer actually fit within that traditional partner support community. And why do these partners crave their own unique environment for betrayal trauma recovery? Because like I said, everything shifts.
Yeah.
At this point. So tell us a little bit about that disconnect.
Yeah. It's such a good question. And I just want to put a yellow highlighter over that last part that you just said, Jen, that they crave their own unique environment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hear this over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let me take the question and divide it into two parts. And let me talk first about kind of the marginalization and the disconnect for these partners, and then what that support system or that craving and need for that support system might look like. So I bring in what I call the roadmap gap. Okay. So I say, picture 20 years ago. So, you know, around about the time you guys all met and became friends and were going through your own betrayal trauma experience for the very first time. Like, this was new. Things like sex addiction, things like partner trauma, things like Barb Steffen's book, Your Sexually Addicted Spouse, Patrick Carnes was barely on the agenda. You know, like this whole concept of sexual addiction, sexual betrayal was so new. There were no podcasts. There were no webinars. There was no YouTube, right? So finding support at all while going through betrayal wasn't easy. if we fast forward the clock to about 10 years ago, things changed in a huge way. This became part of our social conversations. The media and, you know, celebrity situations helped a lot with that by putting it on the map. Resources multiplied like overnight. I can't tell you. There was a time I felt like I could keep up with all the books and all the podcasts and all the websites. And now I give up because it's expounding and expanding so fast, which is a wonderful thing. Okay. So that's a good development for betrayed partners. There are lots of resources out there that say, here's your work and here's your work and here's your relationship work. So yours, mine, and ours, essentially. But if you imagine this being the field wherein you step looking for support, and you look around and you find all these yours, mine, and our resources, all of these support environments that are kind of predicated on this narrative of our marriage was dead and we brought it back to life, and you're not in that category of humans anymore. You're not in that category of humans who are healing together and healing together better and building a new us, all of those sorts of things. He's not getting sober, or you're not getting that disclosure. There are no amends. There's no empathy. There's no recovery. Sometimes you don't even get to make the decision about the fate of the relationship. So when people like that look around to the resources that are available, they find themselves looking at a gap in the roadmap. So the roadmap exists for how to heal back together. The roadmap doesn't exist or hasn't existed. I think we're doing some work there, but hasn't existed to say, this is where your map, your directions, your trajectory, here's what you can expect. And what does it look like to start life over in the aftermath of a betrayal-related separation and divorce? So that's kind of the disconnect that I see happening for individuals who find themselves at this crossroads. When it comes to the support group aspects about it, there's a story I always love to tell from like way, way, way back at the beginning of my coaching career. I was working individually with a client who was going to kind of a classic betrayal trauma support community group. And she was seeing me individually in between. So she would go to the group on Wednesday nights, and then she would come to see me on Thursday. And she was sharing that during the group, she was experiencing all the things that we want betrayed partners to experience in a group. She was realizing she was not the only one to feel this kind of hurt. She was realizing that it wasn't about her. You know, that this wasn't because she wasn't good enough or this enough or that enough or whatever. She saw people surviving the pain, and that gave her a little bit of hope. But she was also hearing stories from everybody else in the room. She was the only one whose relationship wasn't surviving. And in that situation, he left her. So she was one of those cases where she didn't get to make that choice. And she was hearing stories of couples finding forgiveness and having sex again and, you know, facing situations that used to be triggering and now they're going through it together. And she would describe it as like she would go into this room and it would rip off all of the scabs. And all of the healing that she had put together for herself during that week would just come hemorrhaging out. And she would literally go into her room, go into her closet, and cry and cry and cry. And she was confused and conflicted because everyone says, go to a support group. And she went to a support group, and this is what happened. So here's the thing. In my very novice, new coach mindset, I missed some important things that she was telling me. She wasn't just telling me, I go here and I don't feel like I fit in, or I go here and I feel uncomfortable, or I go here and I don't want this to be my story, because like who wants this to be their story, right? She was telling me, I'm going there and I'm getting re-traumatized.
I was just going to say, it's like secondary trauma. Instead of getting help, it's putting her steps backwards.
Yeah, exactly. She wasn't just getting hurt. She was being harmed. So she needed, for her own well-being, to step away from this group that had been her only lifeline in terms of a community and step into an unknown space without that and unsure of how she was going to survive that. So she was the one that first came knocking at my door saying, okay, so where's a group for people like me? And I'm like, okay, I'm well-connected. I know lots of people. I'll find one. And I go to my listservs and I go to my networks and I go to my people and I reach out and I'm like, where's a group for divorced and divorcing partners of sex addicts. Crickets. There wasn't one. So I finally got tired of her coming and asking, where's a group for me, and having to tell her I don't have one. So we went out for breakfast one day and we put together an outline and we started a group. And that was like, what, 11 years ago now. And we've been doing it ever since. But that's really the story that cemented in my mind and my experience in a very vivid way through this woman's story, how necessary it is to be able to find that support and hear those voices of shared experience from people whose trajectory was similar to your own, rather than people's whose trajectory was really going in an opposite direction.
What's tough about that is, what if you don't know what your trajectory is?
Uh-huh.
Your trajectory could be either one. So you want to keep one foot in the camp of, okay, there is hope. People have gotten through this. And also, this is a very real reality that I need to consider. What if you're in both camps? What do you do in a scenario like that? And maybe you have a volunteer coach at a, not coach, but leader at a church or whatever, that isn't necessarily equipped to really hold space for both potential scenarios. What does a woman do in that kind of scenario? Or a person, you know, not just women, but
Well, that's one of the things. So when I get, like, when I get a new client consultation with someone, one of the first questions I'll ask if they're in that kind of decision-making period is what I look at it as, is, do you have people in your life who are navigating divorce in under circumstances like yours? Do you know people who you can talk to and say, what is the grits and the grace of this all? Like, what is the reality of how this plays out in your life? How did you reach that decision? Did you second guess your decision? What was that like? And so I'll often even do consultations with someone who may be in with a really good therapist or a really good coach or a really good support group who doesn't specialize in divorce. And they'll say, hey, can you come have a conversation with us, or can we come have a session with you to be able to ask and answer some of those questions if they don't have it in a more organic way? Because I think being exposed to and being able to make informed decisions and give informed consent to your choices requires getting that information in the first place. And if you don't have it, it's a worthy and legitimate endeavor to try to find it.
Thank you, Ray. The other day, you and I were talking about divorce survivors asking tough questions, questions that are new and big and brave. What are some of the new, big, and brave questions that survivors need to grapple with to finding healing? What are you hearing from your, because this is your niche, this is your area of expertise. What are some of those big, new, and brave questions?
Yeah. So like I said earlier, like, this becomes a one person job. Your healing doesn't involve or necessitate somebody else doing their part, right? So we have to find ways to come to terms with our experience in ways that are very personal, and that sometimes is both like it's an independent job, both by necessity and by opportunity, right? Like, so I had one client who's like, after years of fighting for my relationship, for the first time, it's all about me. And that was both like a positive, like an inviting, appealing thing to her, and a terrifying, intimidating, overwhelming thing, because guess what? It's all about me. So it tends to start with questions like, am I permanently broken? Right? Like, has the stress of this compound trauma, first the betrayal and then the divorce, has the stress of this trauma flattened me beyond repair? Right? Like, that's a very real feeling that I hear expressed by my clients. Can I actually resolve this trauma on my own without my partner? Can I find my own closure? Can I repair these wounds without his or her involvement, assistance, etc.? It transitions along the way to, can I even believe in love and relationships after this, right? Will I always feel cynical and distrusting that true love is possible? I see that smile on your face, Jen. Is there really love that isn't characterized by some kind of entitlement or like that intermittent reinforcement, that love bombing kind of thing? And one of my favorites is like, is what I want for my single future even possible? Like, especially in that period where everything feels worse before it feels better, there's a lot of, can I really do life on my own? Can I really be a single parent to my kids? Can I really support myself financially? Can I really trust my instincts, right? Can I keep myself and my loved ones safe? And kind of like underlying all that is this kind of implicit question of, will it actually be a better life? Because often it's a harder life. Will it be a better life than the one I had with my betraying partner? So that's kind of like where the questions start, where the questions ultimately go, Chris. And this is the exciting part of the passionate part of my work in this arena.
Bring it.
It really leads to questions about identity. And I know this matters to you, right? Yes. Identity and labels and the roles that we choose within our own lives. So the big, big, big question, who am I beyond betrayal trauma? Surviving betrayal trauma can become an identity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It can be all consuming. That's why I love the name of your podcast, right? The transformation component. So we start by kind of like evaluating and assessing and either like embracing or rejecting different labels. So like, if I'm divorcing a sex addict, am I still the partner of a sex addict, right? Like, I'm still carrying the wounds from that partnership, but I'm not necessarily in that same dynamic as I previously was. So do I want that label as validation for the trauma, or do I not want that label because it doesn't fit my current circumstances? We have conversations like, am I a survivor? How does that label or categorization feel? Do I feel like I am a victim? And how do I kind of bring those things into coexistence. I once asked a client, like, what did she want to be called? Like, is there a label or a category that fits for her? And her words were, I feel like a combination of warrior and roadkill. Like, she has this like victor, phoenix kind of idea in her head. And at the same time, she knows that part of her has been flattened and she's not yet sure if it's going to come back to life. So, you know, it all kind of ultimately boils down to, who do I want to be in my post-divorce life? Like, we knew who we wanted to be in our relationships. And there is a sense of really finding purpose and passion about fighting for our relationships. Like, I remember one time, just maybe a year out from my divorce, when I was speaking for a retreat up in the mountains somewhere, and I was speaking to about 80 women who were there for the weekend. And of those 80 women, I would say, 80 to 90% of them were still fighting for their relationships and were in some state of relational healing. And as I was driving away from that event, I was in a car with a coworker, and I looked at her and I burst into tears. And I remember saying to her, I miss my identity as a woman fighting like hell for my marriage. Mm. I loved that role. I honored that role. I believed in that role. And if I was going to move from that state of heartbreak over losing that role, I needed to find something I loved as much.
Mm.
I needed to figure out what was going to be the next thing that I could throw my heart and my soul into. And I'll be honest, for a while, it was work. Like, I jokingly say, work was my rebound relationship because work felt good. I was doing well at work. Things were successful at work. I was validated at work. Things were, I wasn't messing up my life at work, things like that. And then, kind of that balanced out a little bit to a more well-rounded existence. But yeah, that transition from that heartbreak of the role that I once had fighting for my relationship to what was it going to be after? I think that's the biggest, boldest, baddest question we ask.
That's confusing because you feel empowered. There's that sense of, okay, I've got the tools. I understand. I can speak the language. I've got my tribe. I've got a posse backing me up and I'm a superhero in this. I am going to conquer this. And we all want that success story of, this is a marriage that made it and this is how we did it. And look what God did, right? We all want that. Mm-hmm. When we don't get that, there's the death of the marriage, but there's also the death, like you said, of that very empowered identity that evolved mm-hmm. during that healing process. Mm-hmm. So now what do we do with her?
Yeah.
What do we do with her? It's a confusing both and. You know, I oftentimes get frustrated with either ors. I don't want ultimatums. You can either have this or you can have that. And Jen and I have talked a lot on this podcast about that this can be a both and situation. But when there's the death of a marriage, of a dream, like you said, the permanence, there's no hope. You've got the publicity and now you're feeling isolated. Now there's the death of this marriage and this future that you'd imagined for years. And what do you do with that badass, empowered woman or man who was going to conquer this? Mm-hmm. And where do we put that hope? And where do we put that faith? What do we do with her? And I, as I'm listening to you and I'm processing this, I'm thinking she doesn't have to die, but maybe she has to put on a different uniform. Maybe, maybe her superpower getup looks a little different, but that's confusing. And then another thought I had was a quote that Jen loves to bring up is that we will often opt for a known hell over an unknown heaven. So there's that scariness of, okay, I know what this hell is that I've been in and I'm choosing now to, or maybe I haven't chosen, maybe it's being thrust on me that there's a divorce happening. So this known hell is going away and that new heaven is scary. I don't know what this looks like. Can I hope? Can I've often said, could I, you know, if I ever had to be in the dating world again, you know, what would I do? Sorry, if you like me, you are taking a polygraph. I don't care if you are, you know, like the head guy in the choir. I like, right? So how do you move forward out of that known hell into that unknown heaven?
Yeah.
In all of that. That was a lot of thoughts, lots of questions, but any thoughts come to mind, Ray?
You know, what comes up listening to you say that is for years, I had a tiny little post-it note on my laptop and it said, baby steps matter. Baby steps change the world. And I had another post-it on my laptop that said, happiness matters. And then I crossed it out and I wrote, my happiness matters. There was something super powerful about that combination of giving myself permission to take like microscopic baby steps, like seriously, moving into a post-divorce life. I tiptoed. I didn't do much striding. I didn't do much leaping. I really took tons and tons of baby steps and recognized that those baby steps do add up somewhere, like they do get me somewhere. And then recognizing that I put so much focus both during my relationship and at the end of my relationship and getting through the divorce process, which is its own kind of hell, but that sense of what should I do? What was the right thing to do? What did I need to do? And I'd somehow completely lost track of what did I want? What did I want to do? So kind of reconnecting with that idea that my happiness mattered, that was another thing that kind of buoyed me through that confusing time while I was trying to find my footing and kind of get reoriented again.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate that you brought up this, that warrior part of us that has been fighting for this thing. I think many of us translate that empowerment into self-empowerment because so many of us for so long, actually probably most of our lives, didn't really have a whole lot of empowerment in our lives. Or we probably would have noticed the red flag sooner, might have done things a little differently. Who knows? Maybe I'm just speaking for myself. Who knows? But what I appreciate about why you brought that up is because if you look at someone like my marriage, Dan and I have been married 17 years. We are still fighting for our marriage. And now let's translate that back to me, the woman who is sitting in the position of the betrayed partner right now. I like who I am. Mm-hmm. I like that I fight the way that I fight. I like that I process. I like that I dig in. I like all those things. And my 29-year-old son said to me just a few months ago, your whole life has your adult life, since he's been around anyway, last 29 years, has been around betrayal. It's been around the betrayal of my first husband, and it's been around the betrayal of my second husband. And he's like, would you even know what to do with yourself if betrayal wasn't involved? I'm like, okay, that's quite a question. Thank you, son. And I sat with that. I didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that empowerment, the part that I love the most about me, may not even exist without this scenario.
And then I had to think, well, of course it exists. It comes up from inside of me. So then where is she? Where is that empowered individual? The one who finds her voice, the one who speaks her voice, the one who draws boundaries, the one who gets up and keeps going, who has tenacity and fight and drive and all those things. She has to exist outside of the scenarios, right?
Yeah.
So none of the scenarios really get to determine who she is, but many of us can't or don't find her mm-hmm. without the pressures of external circumstances. But when we do, when the divorce comes, when the marriage ends, that doesn't go away. Let's just say she even stays. She's still there. She exists outside of any type of circumstance. So what I want to ask you now is kind of what you talk about as this this empowerment, this survivor empowerment that embraces their stories, but it features an alternative ending.
Mm-hmm.
One without the classic happily ever after, whatever your happily ever after even looks like. I don't know. But there is an alternative ending because of that empowered survivor that is inside all of us. We have survived a ton of things up until even these situations in our marriage, right? Mm-hmm. So can you share a little bit more about this alternative ending?
Yeah.
And the hope and the power that provides, because many of us honestly just don't really know how to transition out of that woman that rose up into her being. Is this making any sense at all? You know what I mean?
Sense. Okay. Can I just say, I think you and I are like on total same wavelength here, because everything you're expressing is at the core. It's like the fundamental components of what we talk about in my work with our clients. So that sense of hope and empowerment, it involves a lot of reframing. I said to a client just this morning, I say it a lot, we need a strong self-talk game. This is where I go back, Chris, to that concept of our trauma has a lot to say to us about a lot of things. And our job is finding out how to talk back to that trauma and how to speak from a voice of healing and really not just take trauma as the last word in our story. So in that reframing and in that talking back, hope and power tend to take the perspective of owning and embracing our truth despite other people's misunderstandings about what's happening in our lives or their projections. So something like filing for divorce doesn't negate the years I've spent fighting for my loved ones, or being on the receiving end of a divorce doesn't mean I wasn't worth fighting for. Like, that was a huge one for me. Being on the receiving end of a divorce doesn't mean that I wasn't worth fighting for. Right? Reaching the end of my rope didn't mean that I don't have what it takes. Having needs doesn't mean I'm too needy. Right? That was a big narrative. We're not some kind of second-class citizens or you know, we couldn't cut it at the marriage game, so to speak. We didn't make that grade. And here's the one of those things. I literally have this now on my laptop. I apparently like to stick things to my laptop, but it says, we are no longer accepting the things we cannot change. We are changing the things we can no longer accept. If that's not empowerment, I don't know what is. And so there is a sense of transition that involves kind of reframing and retalking, creating a new dialogue within ourselves. And that becomes an impetus and a catalyst for behavioral change and change of circumstances. And we get really good at that balancing act piece of things. So that sense that two things can coexist, Chris, it's not an either or, it's a both and. So divorce recovery often involves this nearly constant balancing act. I'm okay and I'm not okay, right? Or learning to cherish everything that was good about a life and a relationship with someone while simultaneously grieving and, as again, as an act of self-preservation, detaching from everything that was so painful and so traumatizing, so harmful. It's like understanding that it's okay to miss someone, even amidst the ugly parts of that abandonment and the abuse and extricating from all that. And that it's normal to feel like this increasing sense of relief and hope and even happiness while moving in a direction you didn't want to have to go. So there's a lot of paradox. There is a lot of ambivalence. There is a lot of reframing and coexistence. And so those dialogues are really where I find the hope and empowerment transition happening.
Did I answer your question?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Jen muted herself because she's coughing right now. But yes, she is giving thumbs up and nodding her head. That's such a what an amazing conversation. There are so many nuances and so many thoughts that, you know, they're kind of resonating in your subconscious, but you never put them into words. And I love what you just said. Just because there was a divorce doesn't mean I wasn't worth fighting for. There's this sense of failure. Toxic shame comes with this, whether you were the one that said the divorce is happening or your spouse made that choice for you. There's all this, you know, the world of grief and loss and messages we're telling ourselves in the midst of that that come with a, dare I say, normal divorce that's not steeped in trauma, whether it's domestic abuse or betrayal trauma or whatnot. And so, you know, it's the both and of I was an empowered superwoman as I fought for my marriage, and I am empowered superwoman as I now go forward to a new future. I'm thinking I can hear Captain Kirk in my head right now as I say that we're going to a land no man has gone before, right? Or at least not this one, no woman. So, thank you for this conversation. This is, like I said, we just scratched the surface and we only asked you a few questions. Is there anything that we haven't asked you, Ray, that you really want to highlight? And so there's one question. And if not, if you feel like this was a good beginning conversation on this, then is there a word of encouragement that you could offer the women or the men who are listening, who are at that precipice of having to deal with divorce? Maybe they're trying to make that decision, or maybe they're already in that process. What word of encouragement would you want to offer them?
Yeah. You know, to the first part of your question, is there anything we didn't touch on? And you're right. We are literally just scratching the surface. I've worked with more than 500 is where I quit counting, divorced partners of sex addicts. And so like, this is something I learn from every single client, and that expands my database of what experiences individuals are navigating through. But the only piece that I think we didn't talk a lot about was the quote unquote business part of divorce. The endless paperwork, the forms, the hearings, the attorneys, the retainers, that is like, I can't even tell you. Like, I'm going to get really vulnerable and really personal here for a second. I don't think I will ever marry again because of that. Like, the emotional trauma of ending a relationship was one thing. But the logistical trauma of having it all play out of my control in family court, that was horrific. I can't imagine ever signing up for the risk of that again. Handling a heartbreak, I could handle a heartbreak. I don't think I could survive another legal process. So that's saying that there's a whole world there. So if that's, I tend to be focused more on the emotional processing side of divorce. And I have great colleagues who are really expert specialists at navigating, especially like the high conflict divorces, where the divorce process itself becomes a mechanism of divorce. It becomes an instrument of abuse. So there's that whole other category of things, which could be a whole other podcast. And I actually give you great referrals of colleagues who would be ideal for interviewing for that if you want later.
Great.
The note of hope. I know you wanted to end on that. And it was funny because I was thinking about this morning. My business coach would tell me that I should give you a quote from myself, from something that represents me, my business, my work, et cetera. But I'm not going to do that because there is a quote from a book that I use when I end most of my divorce recovery support groups. And I love it so much. And I think it's perfect. So if I can just take a minute and read that to you. This is from a book called The Christian Chick's Guide to Divorce, What Your Girlfriends Would Tell You If They Knew What to Say. It's not the biggest or best book on divorce, but I do like a lot of it. The author's name is Suzanne Reeves. And here's the part of the book that I swear I cry every time I read it. She says, I hate how often you are forced to define yourself by your marriage status. I never really cared or noticed before, but now I have to check the divorced box on whatever form I am filling out. But all they give you is a box. No place to clarify. No place to explain how hard you fought. No place to say how painful it is. Only a label, divorced. I had to make the decision that I will not let a label define me. I will not be defined by my marital status. My divorce will always be part of my makeup, and it will always be part of my history, but it is not me. I will always bear the scars, but they are not who I am. My precious friend, don't let these scars define you. They will always be there, but they are not who you are. Early on, I decided to choose life. Through the pain and the tears, I choose life. Daily, sometimes hourly, I choose life. Because of who my God is, I choose life. So if you are sliding down the slippery path toward divorce, choose life. If you receive a knock at the door and the sheriff is standing there with those horrible papers, choose life. If you see your mate walking around town with another woman, choose life. If you have to sell your house, your car, and your wedding ring, choose life. Because God is hope and He is life. If you can do nothing else, if you can't get out of bed, if you can't even pray, take a small step with me today, right now, and choose life.
That's beautiful.
Holy cow. I'm not crying. You're crying. Wow. That was gorgeous. So gorgeous. In fact, could you please email that to me? I've got a group that would love to hear that. Wow. Ray, thank you for joining us today. This was so needed. In fact, I wish we had done this months and months ago. But thank you for sharing your gifts with us and your knowledge with us. And thank you for going forward into this niche that is so uncharted. Jen, I can see you're just pensive and thinking right now. What are your thoughts?
Jen's always pensive and thinking, Chris. We know this about her.
I mean, that's not true. I have seen Jen in a dance party before. Like I've seen Jen throw some confetti.
Yeah, it's true. But there's always some sort of tons of thought behind it, I'm sure. But yeah, I appreciate this conversation because it leaves room for everyone's process to be just that, their very own process. And regardless of what we're facing today, regardless of what choices might even be made for us as a result of someone else's actions, choosing life is always an option. And my guess is, yes, while that quote may come from somebody else, I have a feeling that there is your own version of that quote, Ray, as you work with hundreds of people or have worked with hundreds of people, maybe even thousands. I don't know at this point, but thank you for sharing that. And how can people get a hold of you? Where can we find you? We want more.
Yes. Like the divorce group, is that still going? Where if I'll put a link in the show notes, but I know people who would want to join. Also, I'm curious, is it for women and men?
Great question. So you can find all of my stuff on my website, which is healingtalksback.com. So again, trauma speaks, but healing talks back, healingtalksback.com. And I have a dedicated page on my website that's all of my resources for divorce, divorcing, and separated betrayed survivors. So it's healingtalksback.com/aftermath. So all of those resources are there, including I have an ongoing divorce support group that individuals can join at any point on a month-to-month basis. It's a pay-what-you-can group because there was a time going through my divorce I couldn't afford to put gas in my car. And so I really promised myself that I would never let financial limitations prevent someone from getting support and help. So that's a really easy to access, minimal barriers. We can get you in, plugged in as close as possible to immediately via that. And then I have other more term limited groups that go for 3 months or 4 months. We do one called Who Am I Beyond Betrayal Trauma, you know, where we really dig into what is that identity piece. And we just do a lot of interesting things, post-divorce dating, holiday celebrations when you're home alone, sometimes for the first time without your kids. I mean, there's just all kinds of different things that we as a community have developed from our needs into our kind of mutual reciprocal community care for one another. So healingtalks.com/aftermath.
Okay. And you did say individuals. Does that mean that men would be welcome to join as well?
You know, it's interesting because I began my practice under the name Women Ever After, because I worked almost exclusively with women. I've expanded that so broadly these past few years. So I will tell you, historically, it has been women only, and there is always a time and an opportunity to consider changing that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Ray. All right, on that note, thank you for joining us, listeners, on this episode of the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast. We hope that you found today's discussion insightful and empowering. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Your support helps us reach more listeners who can benefit from these conversations. And again, your reviews and your likes and your sharing it with a friend helps change the algorithm, which helps more people find us. Thank you for allowing us to be a part of your healing and transformation journey. Until next time, be kind to yourself and keep moving forward. Or, as Ray said, choose life.
Thank you for joining us on the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast. We hope you found today's discussion helpful and empowering. For more information, please be sure to check the show notes. Until next time, be kind to yourself and keep pursuing healing. A ministry supported by Pure Life Alliance.